Come over behind me, Mike, and pull this shade down on this light board. Very good. It won't stay. It'll go all the way, Mike. Now get behind me and write on it in big letters. Back the screen up a bit. Back your camera up. Mike, roll out. Right up the top. Rex Lex, R-E-X. And underneath it, write Lex Rex. In the context, that's enough, thank you, Mike. In the context of the Iran scam hearings and all the blowhards of all branches of government spouting off, I want to talk a little bit about the formation of this country tonight. The backdrop of the Constitutional Convention, of which we are now about to celebrate the bicentennial, was a book by Rutherford that posed. I wrote that because I wanted it on that board so you can look at it. Stay back there. A book that raised this issue, Lex Rex, or Rex Lex. I said it the opposite, and had nothing to do with X-Lax. Rex Lex, the king is law. Or Lex Rex, the law is king. Now, it doesn't strike any nerves or jangle any reactions to think of the law being king. But it was a new concept. The king was the law in ancient England, as well as other parts of Europe. The divine right of kings had been accepted, and their word was the law. In the days of Caesar and the church history that we've been studying, Caesar was the law. The king was the law. When he spoke, that was it. Now, the magnificent document called the Magna Carta, as I have said here many times, was given by the king and taken back more than 30 times. Under pressure from parliaments, he would grant those freedoms contained in the Magna Carta. And then when the strength of the king's forces gave him the ability to do so, he had Indian give it, take it back. But the presupposition behind the giving and taking back is the authority for the freedom was in the king. He gave it at his largesse. Now, the writings of John Locke, which postulated the concept of a social contract, also provided a backdrop, but in the minds of many of those meeting at the Constitutional Convention was this earth-shaking concept that the law should be king rather than the king be the law. And the law being in its largest dimension, a social contract between all the citizens of a community and the entity of government, that it contracts away certain things in return for certain benefits, and thus, by that contract, allows the entity called government to exist and function. These provided the backdrop for the formation of this nation. And in that hot little building, the fathers, so-called, of our country, some of whom tried to fulfill that role literally and personally, not all of whom were moral giants. Indeed, many of those present could not pass the test of the media's demands today, crafted out a document for a proposed government that, if accepted by the 13 colonies, would represent a contract between the people and a new entity coming into existence. That entity created by this contract called the United States of America. It had no existence. There was not a United States of America that gave certain rights to colonies. There was not a United States of America that, out of its largesse, granted certain freedoms to the people. There was no United States of America. There was an ununited group of colonies who had coalesced in a war of opposition united by their opposition to Britain. Now the new government is proposed, created by this contractual relationship between the representatives of the people and the newly created entity that would come into being upon the agreement being executed. It had no power. And the social contract, called the Constitution, delineated the powers of government and specified within itself that government was to have absolutely no powers other than those delineated therein. Having crafted the proposed contract, which, if executed, would create the United States of America, the colonies were asked to sign it, and they said no, they would not sign it through their representatives without the addition of a Bill of Rights guaranteeing certain freedoms, which, in the words of the most valuable participant, in my judgment, stated that there are certain inalienable rights given to man not by government, not by a king, but by God. And those inalienable rights, therefore, cannot be infringed upon by government. And it is absolutely my conviction that Jefferson intended not an infringement at all. As time rolls on and men get distant from the realities of the king being law and the denial of freedoms that government, by its very alligator nature, gobbles up, they have found ways to intrude into those freedoms, but they must always give a token wave by giving some plausible rationale for the encroachment. Now, there have been several studies that show if a new constitutional convention were held today and the American public were allowed to vote on a new social contract, they would leave the Bill of Rights out. There is a think tank in Santa Barbara that has proposed a new constitution that leaves the Bill of Rights out. Madison argued that the Bill of Rights of logical necessity should not be added because of a terrible implication, and he was exactly right in his logic. He argued that since the contract specifically states, namely the Constitution specifically states, that government shall have no powers other than those spelled out in the contract, to add a Bill of Rights that says the government can't intrude into these areas is to suggest that the government has reached beyond what the contract says. Since the contract does not give, for example, the government does not give to the government the right to invade free speech, and its power is limited to what is delineated therein, the absence of a delineation of the right to invade free speech is in and of itself a prohibition against invading free speech, and to add a Bill of Rights that says Congress shall make no law that invades free speech is to suggest that there is an implied power not delineated in the contract, so the adding of the Bill of Rights is in itself to open the possibility of an argument that maybe some implied rights are there, not written therein. Madison lost. He was right in logic, but Madison lost because those early founding fathers, many of whom had pledged their lives and their fortunes and their families, knew that it is the nature of government to swell its power outward, and they wanted the double whammy. Not only does the contract say you can't do anything other than what is delineated herein, they wanted to make sure that if they slipped out by any devious guise, there was another wall built around it that says, even if you can somewhere in future generations sneak your way into a broadening of your power, that broadening stops right here on these points. Thou shalt not intrude into these areas. And they wouldn't sign that contract without the Bill of Rights added to it. Now, those rights, by the words of those who brought it into existence, do not come into being by the largesse of government. They do not come into being because government naturally wants those rights protected. They come into being because government was recognized as a predator who would eat those rights up at the first opportunity. And those rights are named and nailed on the masthead as coming from a source outside of government, and government was not allowed, in the case of the United States, to come into existence without recognizing that limit on its rights. Government has no right to be in those territories. As the years have gone on, and as the Supreme Court expanded its right to play God, they saw themselves having to balance the needs of government's existence within its contractual frame and the random factors outside of government control that the Bill of Rights recognized as pre-existing the government and its right to exist. Now, the preamble to that social contract, to borrow from John Locke, said, "We the people, for the people, by the people, for certain reasons that we the people, for our own well-being, want, do agree to this contract and unite ourselves accordingly. Among the things named or to establish justice, for example. That preamble lists several things that are the reasons why the elements of the society that are diverse have agreed to unite and submit to the limited terms embraced in this contract. Now, in balancing the individual freedoms that are named in the Bill of Rights with the social united reasons for contracting together and gelling and submitting to a government subject to the limited terms of this contract called a Constitution, the Supreme Court adopted a practice when government moved into the area of the forbidden fruit, the Bill of Rights, they had to first determine the right of the government to be in the territory based upon a twofold principle that was applied by the court for many years. A clear and present danger to the survival of the Union. Now, this was an addition by the Supreme Court, never ever anticipated by Jefferson and his cohorts, never once thought about. And now you can come to me. The clear and present danger perceived by the colonies was that no matter how limited a contract you might draw up giving limited powers to government, there was always the clear and present danger that the rights would be invaded. And even though the Constitution said no powers allowed to the government except those enumerated herein, they were smart enough to know there was a clear and present danger all the time, everywhere, that government would invade those rights. And they sought to protect certain individual inalienable rights coming to man from his Creator from the ever-present clear and present danger of government encroachment. But in time, a body of men whose payday was dependent upon the survival of government, the men who declared the independence from England and the men who wrote this contract did not need pay from government to exist. They risked everything they had, their treasures, their life, their fortunes, their families, to get free from government encroachment. But give enough generations, and sit nine men behind a black robe pompously on a bench, whose paycheck is dependent upon the perpetuation of government, and they're compromised going out the gate. Just accept that fact. There ain't no way they won't be compromised. You think that they would accept the doing away of government as preferred to the rights? Government didn't exist. The rights existed. Inalienable rights existed. Government didn't exist, called the United States of America. Government, called the United States of America, was allowed to come into existence by a contract that recognized inalienable rights. Now, I'm going to sound like an idealist, and I am. I'm a prophecy teacher, too. And there is no way that Antichrist can come to power until the Bill of Rights is gone. There is no way that Antichrist can come to power. And the wrap-up of history as God intends it occur until the Bill of Rights is gone. It doesn't have to be rewritten, just has to be redefined. And in these 200 years, it's been in a process of being redefined that is accelerating at a rapid rate. But as a history lesson, we better understand which came first. If it was a choice between letting the government be created without the Bill of Rights or having no United States of America, the choice was made. They refused to sign the Constitution executing the contract that brought the United States of America into existence unless the Bill of Rights was attached. What does that say to you? The rights were more important than government. At least the particular government called the United States of America. Once created, however, the inevitable purpose of government is to exist. That's its fundamental reason for being. The stated purpose for government was in the preamble to the Constitution. Because we hold certain things dear. Mutual defense, established justice, all those other things. We contract to let government come into existence. And we pay these servants of ours to carry out these purposes for the well-being of all of us. As long as they stay in their box, they don't do anything that isn't spelled out as their power within the contract. And no matter what possible devious reason might be given, they don't invade inalienable rights. But we got judges and legislators and executors in this threefold balance of power system of government as created by this contract, whose payday is dependent upon government existing. Well, before you're too hard on them, most of you that work, assume you discovered tomorrow that there was some wrongdoing in your companies. You want to go in and suggest that they shut down? It's amazing what values will do when bread and butter is at stake. Now, men are capable of rising to high value as those who signed the Declaration of Independence and pledged their family and lives and fortune, and most of them lost their fortunes. So they conceived the plan that the government could intrude on First Amendment rights, the Bill of Rights in general, if the expression of the right posed a clear danger and a present danger to the survival of the government, the Union. I told you of one case up in Minneapolis where a little lady, for religious reasons, refused to serve on a jury. Went to the Supreme Court. She didn't want to serve on a jury because the Bible says, judge not that you be not judged. That is clearly a religious statement producing a religious conviction that is not so bizarre that it doesn't come under the First Amendment prohibition against Congress making any law that intrudes in upon or hampers freedom of religious expression. It went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court applied the clear and present danger principle. It was a clear danger to the survival of the Union in its purposes to establish justice, because the purposes to establish justice guaranteed the jury system. And if every citizen in the United States refused to serve on a jury because of the religious conviction, judge not that you be not judged, we could not proceed with establishing justice. Therefore, such a religious expression would become a clear danger to the survival of the Union. That's logically sound. But was it a present danger? And the answer there was no. The chances of all the population in America holding that religious conviction to such an extent that juries could not be populated was not a present danger to these United States. Therefore, the Supreme Court upheld her right to be exempt from jury duty as an expression of her religious faith, which she was free to do. During the war, again, as I've told you, newspapers were publishing shipping times for the vessels going out of the harbors on the East Coast. German U-boats merely had to read the newspaper to figure out who to sink. For German intelligence and radio to the U-boats. The government sought to restrict the publication of shipping schedules. In the name of free press and free speech, the order was challenged. Again, the clear and present danger test was applied. Since we were at war, fighting for the survival of the nation, there was a clear danger that the expression of free speech and free press in such a way that could produce our defeat in the war and inability to supply our allies and our own troops, there was a clear danger to the survival of the Union. And in contrast to the woman's religious faith expression that kept her from serving on a jury, in this case, there was a present danger. Not only a clear danger, but a present danger. This had to be stopped immediately, or our shipping lines were destroyed. So in that case, they restricted the free expression. After applying the clear and present danger test, as government continued to grow, can we continue this boring lecture tonight? New York. How can you prove God wrote the Bible, not just a man? I've just tuned you in. What in the hell did you just tune me in and ask a question like that for? I mean, what in the hell makes you think that I want to prove something like that? Where in the hell did you get the idea that I said God wrote the Bible? I mean, if you just tuned me in and asked a question like that, you obviously been listening to these nuts called TV evangelists. And if you've been indoctrinated by their kind, it will take several months of listening to me to get the fog out of your brain. You just tuned me in. Did you hear me say God wrote the Bible? I'm talking about the Constitution. Where in the hell did this stupid question come from? Are you on this planet or is it ricocheting to somewhere else? Well, ain't no way I believe that. Not only is it a stupid question, you're lying. There ain't nobody in God's earth so stupid would tune on a guy with a cowboy hat smoking a cigar talking about the Constitution and expect that guy to respond to a question, how can you prove God wrote the Bible, not just a man? Go milk a duck. What's the matter with you people? You're not even supposed to send me stupid questions like that. This guy must tend Jerry Falwell's outhouse. Plus the fact you cost me 50 cents calling me with that stupidity. Don't get on my telephone if you haven't got brains. This is for intelligent people. Any dumb fool knows God didn't write the Bible. He inspired it, but I don't expect you to know the difference. Anaheim, this is interesting. I'll keep listening. I next person that calls and says, I just tuned in and I want you to give this question, answer it, you say, do you think I want to get my head cut off? He doesn't take questions from people who just tuned in. You earn the right to get me to answer your questions, friend. I ain't looking for an audience. I paid for this time. I don't come cheap. Now, back to the Constitution. Is that real plain?
Yes, sir.
Going to take a lot of calls from New Yorkers tonight to undo that one. Somebody must be visiting from Lynchburg, Virginia. I know some people in that burg that ought to be lynched. Constitutional. Now, after the Constitution was formed by a permissive grant of the people, a social contract that gave them limited powers and specifically stated that the new government called the United States of America was allowed to exist within a limited frame, namely that it do nothing not delineated in the document, with an added moat built around it to keep it in, not to keep people out, that it could not intrude upon certain rights that were inalienable, didn't come from government, came from God, namely the Bill of Rights, the government was allowed to percolate along. Well, the executive and legislative branch and the judicial branch, all of which were created because of the wisdom of men, particularly Jefferson, who recognized that men are sinners, and give them a chance, any one of them, give them an inch, they'll become a ruler, so you create a catfight going out the door to keep balance. They're supposed to have the kind of fights that are going on now with the Iran scam issue. What I get mad about is all these stupid men of the Senate and the Congress mouthing off these moral pronouncements instead of being very honest. Each one of the branches of government will seek, to the best of their ability, to carry out their particular functions, which, if allowed to go unchecked, will destroy the balance between the three, and the other two are supposed to bring them in check. Congress and the executive branch are supposed to quit worshiping black robes and are supposed to make sure that the judicial branch does not become all-powerful. That's why they're going to do everything in their power to make a circus out of the appointment of the current appointee, Bork, to the Supreme Court. That's what they should do. The congressional hearings are designed for no reason other than to bring the executive branch in check. But when they start giving it all these high moral sounds, and they start trying to act like the executive branch shouldn't try to take advantage of the legislative branch, they're just full of hot air. The whole purpose of the situation is each branch ought to try to take advantage of the other branch, and each branch ought to make sure the other branch doesn't take advantage of them. That's what balance of power is. The executive branch is not supposed to police itself and try not to take advantage of the other two branches. It ought to try to take advantage of the other two branches. It's expected it will. That's why the other two branches have the power to hold them in check. And when the news media tries to get the executive branch to give away executive privilege in order to cooperate with the legislative power, they reveal their ignorance of the balance of power concept. The reason executive privilege is in there is just so that the other branches can't take over and destroy the power of the executive branch. They have inherent powers within themselves, created by the document, built up over years of court decisions, and any person that has power in this system and gives it up voluntarily is a fool. And any part of this system that lets someone exercise power beyond the checks that you have on it is a fool. It's the moralizing that makes me sick of these jerks. If they were the president, every damn one of them would do the same thing. Particularly this pompous judge from Maine that still thinks he's a judge. Frankly, if the news media understood constitutional history adequately, they would never refer to the fact that he was a judge. When he stopped being a judge and became a member of the legislative branch, don't try to stack his power position by referring to the fact he was a judge. That's ancient history. He has a different function now. He's no better, no worse. Because he was a judge, yeah, a little worse. This government recognized the inevitable lust for power that resides in mankind. And they knew that no matter how much the document limited the power of government, put men in the posts, their lust for power, their subjective extension of the objective definition of position, would take that objective power and push it beyond what the document said, and that's why the fence was built there for the rights that are inalienable. Well, they became alienable. The first step of alienability was to say, once government was in existence, anything that presented a clear and present danger to its self-perpetuation gave a right to alienate that which was inalienable. Now, you can give all the arguments you want in the world. Pragmatically, it is probably true. The ideals of the founding fathers were beyond practical carrying out. But that shouldn't change those who adhere to ideals from making them work a lot damn harder than they're having to work now to get into that territory. The clear and present danger test suddenly was abandoned a few years ago. It began to be abandoned by the Warren Court, liberal though it was, who expanded the frame of reference of the court into a Reconstructionist viewpoint. Those liberals on the court saw their function from a snide, elitist framework to treat the Constitution as an organic document that must adjust itself to the social needs of the current hour. And in essence, they succumb to a weakness. Now, when I take my horses to Louisville, I intend to print a whole bunch of blue ribbons. A whole bunch of them. For every class, I want to print a ribbon that says, should have won. If I win, don't need that ribbon. If I don't win, it means the judge was wrong. I should have won. So I'll put the should have won ribbon up. Now that's a smart alecky, elitist, asinine view. It's a sinful view to which I will succumb because of the forces within me. And I'm honest enough to admit it. The Supreme Court justices weren't honest enough to admit it. In essence, when you get behind the rhetoric, what they really came to believe, and it was about the same period of time that John Dewey's philosophy took over the educational system of this nation, and progressive education produced a group of elitist educators who felt it was their duty to reconstruct society in the shape of what it ought to be instead of perpetuating what society wanted to be. So the justices decided that they would treat the Constitution in terms of what they thought these founding fathers would conclude if they were presently on the scene and having to apply their viewpoint to current problems. in essence, take it one step further, they presumed to so identify themselves with the mind of the founding fathers that what they should have said about current problems is what they would have them say. So many of the judgments of the court really represented the personal viewpoints of the justices who had to deal with the document. They couldn't get around that, but they found rhetorical ways to make it say what they thought it should have said. So the justices then made decisions based upon should-have-said theory. Stated as would-have-said if the problems of the modern society had been present for them to say it to. And that became the bridge for dropping the clear and present danger test to a new test called compelling state interest test. If the government encroached into the territory of inalienable rights, this could only be done if there was a compelling state interest. Now, it's subtle, but notice the shift from a negative rationale to a positive rationale. And not positive in the emotive meaning of the word good, but rather, instead of reacting defensively, a clear and present danger exists, so in order to survive, we must react and possibly intrude into inalienable rights and alienate them because the expression of them is a clear and present danger to our existence. It suddenly shifted maybe from defensive to an offensive is a better way to put it, because I like the emotive meaning of offense. So let's use emotive words too. The clear and present danger test was a defensive posture. We must survive, and when the expression of the freedoms is a clear and present danger to our survival as a government entity, then we have a right to alienate that which is inalienable. It suddenly shifted to an aggressive, offensive posture. Not just keeping the government alive, but a compelling state interest, a feeding of the appetite. A compelling state interest can simply be the government wants to do it and figures out some fancy words to justify it. Compelling state interest becomes nothing but an absolute license for any creative government agency that comes up with a reason that somehow they can say it adds to the reasons for government's existence. That is a compelling state interest. I don't need a banana split at midnight. I can argue it rushes the blood to my stomach and makes me go to sleep easier. That's a compelling state interest. An attacker coming in my bedroom at night with a knife and wanting to cut my throat presents a clear and present danger. And as ludicrous as it sounds, those two illustrations come close to what's happening. Compelling state interest gives the government the right to give fancy reasons for constantly eating banana splits. But they put a tailor on it that did restrict them a little bit. The compelling state interest had to be adjudicated, first stated and adjudicated, prior to the invasion of the rights, and a PS had to be put on it. This compelling state interest cannot be served or met by a method less intrusive into the inalienable rights than the one proposed. In short, the government had a duty to first state a compelling interest for the intrusion, and second, present a case that other alternatives were considered and there was no other method of carrying out the compelling state interest of less intrusive quality than the one they were using. Said differently, to serve the compelling interest and alienate the inalienable, they had to make a demonstration that the alienation was the least alienation that was available in the case at issue. If there was another way to serve the compelling state interest that alienated to a lesser degree, that's the one they had to take. And when they chose a path, they had to demonstrate that other alternatives had been considered, and this was the least offensive of them all. In recent years, the PS has been dropped, and the twofold test has become a single test, and more, we saw it in our own cases, all the state had to do was state a self-defined, compelling state interest, make no attempt to find a lesser alternative, just simply say, there is no other alternative but this, and permission was granted. That's how far we've moved from the inalienability. After the state called the United States of America was formed, law was king. Early on, it was decided that all laws bowed to the supreme law of this land, and the king of this land was the Constitution. That's what the Iran scam issue is about. Not the congressman, not the president, not the judiciary. The Constitution of the United States is the issue. The reason Ollie North struck a chord with the American public, he revealed he was a better scholar on the Constitution than some of those interrogating him. One thing to say you violated the Constitution is another thing to prove it. But spent a lot of time trying to say these people were violating the law. Which law? They felt they were upholding the highest law of the land, and it's not for Congress to adjudicate that. That is not their division of government. And these witnesses before the Congressional Committee have every right to say, it's not your position to adjudicate the rightness or wrongness of this, the legality or the illegality of this. That's a matter for the courts to determine. Congress is supposed to ascertain facts in order to enable it better to carry out its function, which is to pass laws subject to the highest law of the land, the Constitution. Having early on ascertained that the highest law of the land was the Constitution, and all other laws were subject and subordinate to it, the issue came before the courts and was settled in the Washington case. That when anyone acting under color of law performed a duty, the law they were enforcing was presumed valid. Now come over here behind me and put TV on the wall. Underneath Lex Rex, put in red letters TV. Put it off to the left. Wait a minute, right there. I go over about the same position on the other side and put PP. PV for presumed valid. People raised issues concerning intrusions into their rights by people coming under color of law. Now, we've all seen the old-fashioned Western movie, and we've read the Western novels about the sheriff who comes to town, and his sole function is to enforce the law. He doesn't ask whether it's right or whether it's wrong. He just carries it out. The law is king. Lex Rex. People challenged the right of a man to carry out a law on the assumption that the law just might not be constitutional. And it was therefore decided by the courts that this country can function only if we presume that properly elected lawmakers, sworn to uphold the Constitution, when they act in deliberation to make a law, whether it's municipal, state, county, national, they are acting with their best judgment within the shadow of the highest law of the land, which is the Constitution, authorized so to act by the Constitution, sworn so to act in upholding of the Constitution. Therefore, for this society to function, it must be presumed that when any agent of government comes to enforce a law that has been passed by a proper legislative body, that law must be presumed valid. And if you as a citizen receive something that you think is wrong treatment by some person acting as a law enforcement officer under color of law, and you want to challenge his right so to act because you believe that his action in enforcing the law and the law itself perhaps is unconstitutional, the burden of proof. Come back over here, Mike. I'm putting blue letters under PV, BP. The burden of proof now put between PV and PP the word people. No, don't put that. Put the word government. Put the word state. Just write state in there. Way down at the bottom of the board, write the word people. Now, the burden of proof, draw an arrow from burden of proof to the people on the PV side. Right there, just draw the arrow down to the people. If you want to challenge the action of any person enforcing the law on the grounds that you think they violated the Constitution, the presumption is validity of the law, and if they act under color of law, the burden of proof is on the people. They can come and act. And after the fact, in short, people are on the defensive. Properly constituted representatives of society have passed the laws. The law is king, and it is presumed valid, and the people, if they challenge it, have the burden of proof on the defensive. After the law has been enforced, you have the burden to prove that the law being enforced violated the Constitution. That means you come in from a defensive posture after the fact. Let's take the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. If you run a business and feel like that some law is passed that expresses the commerce powers granted in the Constitution, are violated, and you feel that you've been violated by some state or local law, you have a right to challenge it. You file a lawsuit. They're going to enforce the law until you prove them wrong. You're on the defensive. Now, those who just joined us, we're live. And we're 1 hour into a lecture on constitutional history. The founders of this country were well informed with a revolutionary book that postulated the issue, is the king law or is the law king? Social ferment was everywhere, and John Locke had introduced the revolutionary idea of the law of contract being applied as a social contract between people and government. And the Constitution of this United States was such a social contract and the government called the United States of America did not exist until the contract was executed, and the contract itself brought the government into existence. Contrary to England, where the Magna Carta was a contract given to the people by the king, with the power of the king to withdraw it, as he did more than 15 times, and then replace it some 30 times altogether. It went back and forth. This country was formed by a social contract. The contract said the government had no powers other than those delineated therein, but to make sure that the government stayed inside its box, certain rights were declared to be inalienable, and until the Bill of Rights that recognized those inalienable rights was attached to the contract, it would not be executed and the government couldn't come into existence. The Bill of Rights was added, the government came into existence. As the government functioned over the years, the issue was raised. Once it was recognized and established by the court that the highest law of the land, the law that was king par excellence, was the Constitution, the supreme law of the land, and all other laws underneath it derived from it. Therefore, if a law was passed by someone and that law was not in accordance with the highest law of the land, nevertheless, the good faith effort of legislators sworn to uphold the Constitution to pass a law, not all laws that they sit down and ask, is this constitutional? When the automobile was invented, they passed laws that limited the speed it could travel. Some of them are still on the books. There are probably laws in some states that when a vehicle goes down the road, somebody must walk in front of it. Nobody's bothered to take them off the books. There was a very popular book written a few years ago of archaic laws that have no meaning that still are on the books in various places. But it was assumed and settled in a Supreme Court case that when legislators acted, they were acting in good faith as sworn upholders of the Constitution. Thus, when you went out and hired somebody to enforce the law, he didn't have to be a constitutional scholar. When he acted under color of law, his actions were presumed valid, and if they stepped on somebody's toes, the people had the burden of proof. That's why burden of proof, BP, has an arrow going to the people. You had to come in on the defensive and say, hey, wait a minute, this law is unconstitutional, and you had to prove it. But in a case started down in Texas, Collins v. Thomas reached the Supreme Court a few years ago. The universal application of the principle of presumed validity of the law was corrected. This case said there are certain rights that have a preferred position. Those rights are written into the Bill of Rights, particularly First Amendment, and that particular case had to do with freedom of association, one of those that's in the First Amendment. And the court declared, and it has not yet been overruled, and it is the present position of the land, that certain rights embraced in the Bill of Rights have such a preferred position in this society that when a law, in other circumstances presumed to be valid, intrudes into the territory of these preferred position rights, the burden of proof issue changes. Put burden of proof, put BP under PP, right? Now draw the arrow to the state. When the law intrudes into preferred position rights, the burden of proof, raise your camera or something, or move sideways, Mike, until you can get the camera a little better. When the law, which is king, draw a red line through Rex Lex, Mike, the United States, first country in the world to do it, make it a big scratch out. I mean, go two or three lines bold and broad. That's it. That's good. Well, I rather like that one you were about to draw. In the United States of America, lex rex, the law is king. And when laws are passed, they are presumed valid. And when someone acts under color of law and intrudes, in your view, upon the Constitution, the law is presumed valid. Good faith is a defense of the action of the law enforcement agent, and you, the people, have the burden of proving the law unconstitutional to stop the activity which is enforcing the law. But when the law intrudes into those PP, preferred position rights, they have a standing, and this was a throwback. Thank God for Thomas V. Collins. Thank God for it. That went back to a recognition of the founding fathers of the priority position of these inalienable rights. And what the court said is that the burden of proof is on the state to prove the validity of the law, which said proof is not violating the Constitution before intruding. Now, the way in which that proof of validity occurs is, one, you prove that there is no violation of the Constitution itself, and two, you prove there's no invasion of these rights, or you offer a compelling state interest for the intrusion, even though the law does intrude and there is no other alternative available that is less intrusive into this. Now, I've said over these years, I was taught on this, you walk around, if you're a government agent, in the territory of PV all you want, but don't get on my PP, or you got one hell of a fight. Now, what the news media is doing is they are seeking to make... Now, come over here, Mike. Take your red letter and draw on that letter from the burden of proof that goes to the state. Just do a little squiggly through that arrow with a red pen. Just squiggle it. That's it. And continue the squiggly and use the same red letter and turn it and make the arrow go to the people. And right across that arrow, news media in small letters. I don't want them to think they're big at all. See what they want to do? They want the burden of proof to be on the people at all times. That way the government doesn't have to be on the defensive. The people stay on the defensive. In every case except the press. Now, if the government tries to get into the press, man, you're going to read headlines on every front page in America, blood on the First Amendment. Now, what's this got to do with what I've been talking about since Sunday? The whole hue and cry across America for churches to open up and disclose everything that they know to everybody is to place a burden of proof on churches to justify their right to exist. Now, I have said over and over again, if somebody said I was beheading babies as a religious sacrificial rite, burying their torsos and heads under the platform of my church, and someone came and said, oh, come on, Dr. Scott, we know this charge is false, so make it easy for us, let us in, we'll together lift up the floorboards of the platform, we'll even pay the expense and prove there's nothing there and let this thing go away, I would say, up yours. You go out and you establish probable cause. You give your compelling state interest and no lesser alternative. and you get your witnesses and you do your homework, but you're still going to stand in front of the doors of a church with sweat on your palms and pause at the threshold with the knowledge that you may be a moron with a brain the size of a rat, but you know when you move inside a church under the auspices of government for any reason, you have moved into preferred position territory. And the burden of proof, no matter how terrible the charge, is still on the government to prove its right to go in. The terribleness of the charge is a very good argument for the compelling state interest. But you don't short-circuit it and create a precedent for a practice that the state can walk into these preferred position territories for any reason without trembling. In the age when the king was law and Mordecai went to Esther, she said in her defense for not going in, if you walk in the presence of the king and he doesn't raise the scepter of approval, you're dead. No matter how justifiable the reason for going in, the risk was there that if you presumed to go in the king's presence and he disapproved your being there, no matter how worthy your cause that you came to plead, if he raised the scepter a certain way, you were dead. Because the king was law. Here the law is king. And I'm sorry, the nature of the formation of the law that created by contract the government we call the United States placed a priority on the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights was not adopted and the rest of the Constitution allowed as a concession because of its prior importance. Rather, the Constitution had to recognize the inalienable rights before it could exist. These are priority position. These are preferred position rights. The principle is you defend them at all costs, or the day comes when the people are on the defensive and there are no preferred position rights, and everything that the government decides to do is presumed valid, and with unlimited resources and unlimited power, you must defend against their action. Now, people said over and over, why do you defend so hard? My undergraduate major is history. I read for the political science prof in the days of loyalty oaths. You give up a freedom to government there has never been in history an opportunity to get it back except by threat of force that overpowers that government. It is not the nature of government to give you freedom. What they want is to engage in benevolent dictatorship and largesse. They say, give us the power, we won't abuse it. Never in the history of mankind has the government been given that power that they haven't abused it. Now, in the current brouhaha, what we are seeing happen is a man like Jerry Falwell, whom everyone in the world recognizes, engaged in a hostile takeover of an organization probably worth $500 million, and it was the slickest takeover to ruthless people on the street. They begrudgingly admire the fact that he was able to pull it off. And to strengthen his ability to retain what he grabbed. If I were Jerry Falwell, I'd say, I got up that morning and took a half bottle of my wife's medicine, and I was drugged. I don't know. I don't know who his attorney is. If I were in Jim Baker's position, I'd end up owning Lynchburg. Without taking sides on the rightness or wrongness of what's going on, it's just obvious that Jerry Falwell engaged in a hostile takeover of an organization of a different theological foundation. And in order to entrench his position, the only way he can survive against a comeback from Jim Baker is to have Jim Baker adjudged a criminal. I told you that from the beginning. I told Jim Baker himself, you don't fight, you're going to jail. And he will go to jail if he doesn't fight. And he may wait too long to fight. Maybe he should go to jail. The only way that he can be blocked in his response is to marshal the powers of government to indict him with sufficient criminal charges that he has no power base to come back with. And the way that's done is give the key to the government in a interlocked arm-in-arm alliance, come in and seize all the records and then search. Now, there is a big difference between searching and seizing. Search warrants have to be specific. There has to be probable cause and certain other tests for the violation that is going to occur to someone's privacy. And you come with probable cause of finding a certain thing, and you are searching in a specific place to seize that specific thing. What is going on at PTL is that the new ruler therein, Jerry Falwell, has given the keys to the government to come in to priority and preferred position territory, obviously a religious organization that is pregnant with preferred position rights, and said, here, come in. No burden of proof required, because the boss man who took over in hostile takeover has said, here, I'll let you in. You don't have to prove anything. You don't have any burden to prove your right to be here. I'm telling you, come on in, get him. Seize everything and then search till you find something wrong. And in so doing, they seize the personal donation records. They have access to the sacred religious records of the thousands of innocent donors to PTL who are the victims, if wrongdoing occurred, they're the victims in the first place of any frauds that occurred. And now they're being made a victim second time around by having their religious rights invaded with no burden of proof on the part of the state or compelling state interest, and no lesser alternative to carry out the compelling state interest for the trampling around on the right to give in secret that many of the people who gave to PTL believe in, because some of them now give to me and have said so. In order to retain a personal kingdom of power, precedents will be set that will make it impossible ever for certain religious rights to be protected again. That affects every citizen of this United States. Then all the rest of these TV evangelists, in order to gain the goodwill of the church world in general, who are seeking to attain the goodwill of the world in general, are listening to the news media and are on a disclosure kick. Now, how long do you think the news media would applaud if we suggested that in order to catch all criminals that are possible for the good of society, that all informants to all newspapers and radio stations in America be disclosed tomorrow? And why don't we make every publisher in America pass a litmus test proving that they won't engage in any pornographic phraseology or visual presentations and prove they never have before they can publish anymore? And why don't we have an annual report in every newspaper? I mean, you know, they can print it pretty cheap. They print the paper, just put an extra edition in. They list their informants. And make all newsmen and newspaper women take urine and blood tests weekly for the next 52 weeks to make sure none of them take cocaine. as the price of infecting our minds with their ostentatious declaration of the news. You see, it's a single-minded attack on religion. Disclose, disclose, disclose. No burden of proof that the state has a right to know this. No specificity of application, but just a broad brush. Anyone who preaches, anyone who is a religious leader, any church organization now must disclose. Why? Now, the essence of financial power is secrecy. Anybody with any financial acumen knows that. Because secrecy gives the ability to maneuver. Capitalism creates an economic battlefield. And to function on that battlefield, you've got to have some secrecy. That's just the nature of things. And what is sought is to render the church powerless. Plus the presumptions that the government has the right to determine what is adequate compensation for a minister. We fought that out in the state of California. The Petras Bill was a response to the Attorney General in California taking the posture that he had a right to determine what was reasonable as salary for a minister. That leads me to the Bible. Isaiah 39. At that time, Merodach Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, page 791, if you've got a Bible like mine, for he'd heard that he'd been sick and was recovered. And Hezekiah was glad of them and showed them the house of his precious things, the silver, the gold, the spices, and the precious ointment, and all the house of his armor, and all that was found in his treasures. There was nothing in his house, nor in all his dominion, that Hezekiah showed them not. That passed muster today, wouldn't it? That's adequate disclosure. There was nothing in his house nor in all his dominion that Hezekiah showed them not. Then came Gene Scott the prophet. And said unto him, then came Isaiah the prophet unto King Hezekiah and said unto him, what said these men? And from whence came they unto thee? And Hezekiah said, they're come from four country unto me, even from Babylon. They wrote a letter and won a financial statement. Then said he, that is Isaiah the prophet, what have they seen in thine house? Hezekiah answered, all that is in mine house have they seen. There's nothing among my treasures that I've not showed them. I have nothing to hide. How can I float out? I have nothing to hide. Bob Shuler. I have nothing to hide. Porky Pig Falwell. I have nothing to hide. Faded Bouquet Graham. Jimmy Swaggart. Nothing among my treasures that I've not showed them. Then said Isaiah to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house and that which thy fathers have laid up in store unto this day shall be carried to Babylon, nothing shall be left, saith the Lord. I'm telling you, Antichrist is on his way as the king of Babylon was on his way to Jerusalem. And I'm talking about on his way historically. The inevitable was on its way. Babylon would conquer. The inevitable is on its way in this world. Antichrist is going to come on the scene. He will rule through the power of government. No man can buy or sell without his number, and number in the Bible means possession. And his number is 666, and no man will be able to buy or sell without his number. You already see it happening. As department stores and banks are adding 666, the easiest number to matriculate through a computer, that it might tie in with that beasted Belgium, and the beast is not the Antichrist, he's a person, but they call it the beasted Belgium, that master computer where they hope eventually to feed everything in. And government will not stop until it has the capacity to find any and everything that any and everybody has. That's why I say the essence of financial power, and the essence of financial power also includes the essence of freedom, is secrecy. There can be no freedom and there can be no power when secrecy's gone. Only the one that knows all the secrets of everyone else and has the freedom and power not to reveal its own secrets will be all powerful. My Bible says that Antichrist cannot come to power until that which restrains him or holds him back is taken out of the way, and that is the church. And I may be the only voice in America today that is saying the church equally has the job not only to teach all nations and get the gospel out, but to resist Antichrist. And damn it, I'm resisting him with every bone in my body, and over my dead body will he take over those secrets that belong to this church. I will not be on the defensive about that. Antichrist is getting his job made very easy. And the spirit of the false prophet is at work, because if you will read that chapter in Revelation where Antichrist marks people with his number, it is the false prophet, not the Antichrist, it's the false prophet that makes the people take the mark of the beast and bow down to him. False prophet cannot the Antichrist cannot come to power, exercise his control without a false prophet that causes the people to give in. And the false prophet looks like Christ, but when he speaks, he gets his message from the dragon. And as the spirit of Antichrist was at work as early as Paul and is still working in the land today, the spirit of the false prophet parallels it and is at work. And there is no man in America more embodying the spirit of the false prophet in this respect than Jerry Falwell. And all his cohorts who are suggesting that the church bow down to government to get the approval of the world. The burden of proof is not on the church. Our rights are inalienable. The burden of proof is on the state before they even walk into the territory. And I will not do what Hezekiah did. For Isaiah said, "Hear the word of the Lord of hosts." Everything is going to be taken from you that you showed him. To you that just joined us, I'm in the middle of something. Then said Isaiah to Hezekiah, chapter 39 of Isaiah, "Hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house and that which thy fathers have laid up in store until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, saith the Lord." Jerry Falwell has destroyed PTL. It may exist for a while, but as he opened the door for the state to move in without requiring that they display a burden of proof before they got in, and adjudicate the constitutional issues before they move into the territory he has destroyed them. There is no sin that Jimmy Baker could commit or repeat in multiplied occasions thereof that matches the sin against God and the innocent donors to PTL that Jerry Falwell has committed by inviting the state in. And anyone, anywhere, that is a member of any Christian communion has been violated as these rights, particular to PTL, have been trampled on. In addition, shall be carried to Babylon, nothing shall be left, saith the Lord. Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house and that which thy fathers have laid up in store until this day shall be carried to Babylon, nothing shall be left, saith the Lord. And of thy sons that shall issue from thee, which thou shalt beget, shall they take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Not only will you lose your treasure, your capacity to reproduce is going to go, and you'll die with this generation. That's why Daniel and the three Hebrew children were eunuchs. All the young men taken to Babylon and emasculated. The church that opens up to the instrument of Antichrist, which is government, will have all that it has taken from it. And that's the design. That's the ultimate hidden agenda of the disclosure movement. And the church's capacity to reproduce is gone. And the path is made clear for Antichrist to move in, and the only prophets left are the false prophets. That's why I won't join the race to this world's approval of disclosure. It is theologically and biblically prohibited. It is anathema to the faith that is in Christ and the biblical foundation of the church to so yield. But what's even more important, we're not in Caesar's Rome. We're not in Rex Lex of England. We are in a country ordained of God. And Romans 13 says the powers that be are ordained of God. Down south, they used to say when a cop would show up, the law is at the door. No, the law is not at the door. A representative of the law is at the door. The law is king. Persona implemented. The highest law of the land is the one that was ordained of God. God created and allowed this country to come into existence that the voice of the gospel might go out in the last days and this country might fulfill its predestined purpose in God. Romans 13 might create strictures if you were in another country where Rex was king, where the king, or where Rex was law, where the king was law. But in this country, that which is ordained of God is that which was the supreme law of the land. All laws derived from it, and that law is prohibited from intruding into preferred position rights. And even with the current interpretation of the courts, the burden of proof is on the state to prove up its case, namely its right to get into that territory before it comes in. For no reason do they get in without such burden of proof being first met. In my case, for 11 years we stood on that principle. We paid the equivalent of $150 million in penalties by the loss of our licenses. And now after these many years, the Ninth Circuit finally said we were right. That the right to give in secret is a constitutional right that must be adjudicated prior to a lower court decision. Dust is not yet settled from that remand. We were right all along, and I'm right now. And you churchmen that listen to me that don't have the gonads to act and the brains to know that I'm right, I feel sorry for you. But whether anybody else acts in this country or not, I'm acting. They come and ask me for disclosure, I'll say, up your nose with a pine tree. And a jackhammer. Clear?
Yes, sir.
We're going to be a church that reproduces. And you who agree with me now, get on the telephone and let's wave the flag across America.